Folks, it is 1 o'clock. We're going to start. Please take your seats. A presentation. Mr. Thomas, did we allocate
60 minutes?
60 minutes. Okay. Okay. Oh, come forward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, board members and staff. Thank you for continuing this workshop and allowing the public additional opportunities to weigh in on the ag waiver. My name is Tracy Roberts. I am the Environmental Resources Coordinator for the Monterey County Farm Bureau, part of a multi-organizational group. I have been asked to introduce the agricultural group's presentation today, and I want to make note that we heard some very important information this afternoon before the lunch break from the Environmental Justice Group, and I want to assure you that everyone in this room and beyond these walls understands how important that information is. My job is to briefly remind you about what is contained in the ag proposal and of the requests that you made to staff at the end of the last workshop in May. Our other presenters will then address the technical basis for the ag proposal. So in my first slide, it just lists the requests that were made by you, the board members, to staff at the end of the workshop, in discussion at the end of that, respond to legal issues raised, assess staff resources to accomplish existing workload, justify costs, justify amount of information reasonably needed, consider at least a 10-year program, tackle higher priorities first, acknowledge complexity, acknowledge that the complexity means solutions can take more than 10 years, and realize that an engineering approach is not effective to address multiple and diverse farming operations. We are focusing today's presentation on the technical basis for our proposal. We are not bringing you a lot of additional detail on the ag proposal because we are in the process of vetting those specific concepts with growers throughout the Central Coast, and this does take time. We will talk about why our proposal is the most likely to result in actual water quality improvement, and we will highlight for you complex issues that need to be understood in order for us to be successful, such as load versus concentration and salinity management, to name just two. Issues like these have to be considered in designing a streamlined, effective, and feasible program. We have growers here today with experience in identifying problems and addressing them. They will talk to you about their successes and their ongoing challenges that require continuous refining and the incorporation of new information that is not always readily available. It is important that groundwater be addressed, and it will be today, by other speakers. The reason that our group has chosen not to spend much time on groundwater today is that there are very important technical issues related to surface water that have not yet been adequately addressed. Rather than try to do everything at once, we believe it is prudent to address one issue at a time and fully focus our attention and efforts towards solutions that will be effective, with achievable, and with measurable goals. We hope you agree, because the condition of aquifers needs to be looked at more carefully and addressed. Although, as many would have you believe, it is not so simple as to say this is just an irrigated agricultural issue. We must all do our part, but it is critically important that everyone have clean drinking water, and we wholeheartedly support that. The components of the ag proposal are as follows: grower annual report and farm plan, continuing education, cooperative monitoring program monitoring, watershed-focused confidential field sampling, practice implementation and evaluation, and a better understanding of aquifer conditions. It's a well-thought-out proposal without a lot of bells and whistles, and it will allow us to do several things. Continue to monitor water quality at key locations throughout the region so that we will have a longer-term database that we believe is necessary to better assess change over time and evaluate the waiver program. With today's data, we cannot make a full and proper evaluation of the current program. It will keep communication and dialogue between you, the board, and staff on a regular basis with annually presented reports. It will help us focus efforts and resources where they will be most effective. It will engage the best thinking of growers and researchers to find the most effective solutions. Also, as board members requested and suggested, our proposal acknowledges the complexity of the problems we are trying to solve and realizes that solutions will take longer than 10 years. Here's where we are today. One question has been answered. Are there water quality issues that agriculture needs to address? Yes. The question yet unanswered cannot be answered without effort, trial, and more effort. That is, what can I do on my particular farm to create the greatest benefit for water quality? We hope that you will get a clear picture of why this question is yet unanswered as we go through our presentations today. Thank you.
Could you display the clock? Could you display the time clock up here? Did you start that at 1 hour? Yeah, that was it.
You can go ahead and start it now. 1 hour.
This group gets an hour. It's one presentation. Yeah.
59 minutes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Jeffries. I will now leave.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. The technical issue is resolved. Again, Kirk Schmidt, on behalf of Preservation, Inc., addressing smart sampling. Smart sampling is very similar to what Preservation, Inc. does in its confidential on-farm sampling program presently. Presently enrolled in the and registered with the Region 3 are about 1,800 growers representing 389,000 acres. Based on their filings, 318,000 acres are without tailwater. That's 81%. There's an estimate of 10,000 farms in the region. There's no certainty of this number because this is not contained in your database and no one has endeavored to determine the number of individual farms. If the number of acreage to tailwater is applied to the farms, 8,100 farms would have no tailwater. That would leave 1,900 farms with tailwater runoff. That's a large number. On the average, assuming an average 100-acre farm, most farms are irrigated on planned blocks with differing irrigation cycles, practical limitations on well output, as well as limitations on by weather, affect timing flexibility. As the irrigation rotates between blocks, possibly over several days, the runoff varies by flow, location, and duration. The draft waiver provides for mandatory on-farm monitoring that is based on the belief that farms are an industrial point source discharge instead of ag operations with multiple or variable sources of non-consistent flows. Therefore, it is going to be difficult to design a monitoring program. How do you monitor for flows with variable discharge locations into a common shared ditch? How do you determine average or high flows? What time of day? How often? Should we select the first Thursday of after the full moon? It is impossible to implement consistently. The costs are unknown. There is no MRP draft that's available at this point, and it's unlikely to be equitably enforced. We've already discussed at prior meetings how there are some areas, there are some watersheds that are significantly impaired. The Preservation, Inc. data shows that, to some extent, everyone in some of these watersheds is contributing to the water quality circumstance in those watersheds. So it's really not necessary to require all growers above the cooperative monitoring site to monitor. Why? To see who's contributing, if all are. Why not skip the monitoring on each farm because of the difficulty and expense, save the money, and implement management practices above impaired cooperative monitoring sites? Actually address what is necessary to improve water quality. Verification of practices by staff with audits of annual reports and enforcement. This would allow farmers to apply the money to practices instead of duplicative monitoring. And this would be supported by the existing cooperative monitoring sites with the possibility of additional rotating upstream sites to verify compliance and show improvement. Now, smart sampling is real science. It provides accurate real-time data. Smart sampling will give a greater impact on improved water quality by assisting the grower. One key factor is that on-farm, the smart sampling results in on-farm review of the results with the grower, something that reported monitoring will not result in. Smart builds on the existing cooperative monitoring data so that it can be focused on known impairments. It's instantaneous, with results for most of the constituents present within minutes after the sample is taken. It's cheaper. Some of the methods can be repeated by the grower on site repeatedly afterwards on their own with relatively high results. The success of smart sampling is that it will improve water quality, and that's really our goal.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young, members of the board, Mr. Briggs. I'm Sarah Green with the Cooperative Monitoring Program, and I'm just going to go over some examples of how smart sampling has worked so far. There's two objectives for smart sampling. One is to discover water quality issues in farm discharge, and then beyond that, the farm-specific sources for any constituents of concern that we find in that discharge. And the second objective is to assess the water quality outcome of any management practices or operational changes that are made to improve water quality. So technically speaking, we're looking for nutrients, toxicants, and suspended sediments in the discharge. In other words, we're looking for fertilizers, soil amendments, crop protection materials, and eroded soils. Right after I made the previous slide, I was poking around the UC Farm Water Quality Planning fact sheets online, and I found this quote, which is that, "A valid evaluation design is necessary if you're going to identify the changes to water quality that result from modifications to farming operations. It should answer two questions. Is water quality degraded as a result of farming operations? And if water quality is degraded, is water quality improved by subsequent changes in farming operations?" So it seems that we've successfully reinvented the wheel here to some extent. And maybe what we're saying is really just that we had this very useful concept in the current waiver, and it just needs a little bit more focus and attention in the future. Kirk went over some of this information, so I'll just skip on to the examples. These are examples of smart sampling that was done with growers in the Salinas, Santa Maria, and Pajaro watersheds. We've actually done smart sampling in all the hydrologic units, but these are just some examples, and they mostly come from vegetable and nursery operations. So grower number three, we tested the tailwater for fertilizers, organophosphate pesticides, and sediment. That grower identified the source of high nutrients in their tailwater and is attempting to either reduce or eliminate OPs from their tailwater, that's organophosphates, and they're currently retesting to determine the effectiveness of those efforts. Grower number 20, we did the same kind of testing, and that grower now has a plan to eliminate tailwater. They implement more each year as fast as is economically feasible for them. Grower number 36 hired an intern to implement an operation-wide water quality testing program, so I'm working with that intern on methods and objectives for their testing, and they're now working on water and soil monitoring to determine options for reducing tile drain nitrates and exploring vegetative treatment methods. Grower number 17 tested the tailwater for fertilizers, organophosphate, pesticides, and sediment. Their past efforts to reduce organophosphates appear to have been successful, so they're now adjusting fertilizer application methods to reduce end-of-row granule dropping, which contributes to high nitrates in their discharge. Grower number 25, we tested for nutrients, turbidity, and organophosphate pesticides above and below a 100-foot-long ditch section that was densely vegetated with watercress. We saw no measurable change in nitrates, phosphates, turbidity, chlorpyrifos, or diazinon. Both of those are organophosphate pesticides. Below versus above the vegetated ditch section. We also conducted some edge of field testing to look at organophosphates in tailwater from different irrigations throughout a crop cycle, and that grower is experimenting with PAM, polyacrylamide, to drop sediment out of their tailwater and also other management practices. Grower number 35 has no surface runoff, so we tested their leachate for nitrates, and as a result of that testing, that grower is reevaluating the length of their irrigation sets and also the quantity of fertilizer applied, and then we'll retest to see if any changes occur. Grower number 30 evaluated a vegetated ditch for nutrient removal, and that ditch had low flow rates and low to moderate nutrient concentrations to start with, and what we found was that one segment of the ditch was more effectively removing nutrients than the other. And so that grower is going to make improvements to the lower-performing ditch segment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Young, board members, and staff. I'm Tim Burrell, and I'm the production manager at Blanco Farms in Salinas. I'm a third-generation California farmer who enjoys the challenges of agriculture here on the coast, whether it's a day-to-day operational issue or the long-term goal of better water quality. I'd like to share with you my experiences on one of our ranches. It's become our test property for water quality improvements. It's a working R&D parcel that continues to operate as a normal farm. It's appropriately named the Esperanza Ranch, which means hope in Spanish. But most important to me, it lies in the Quail Creek watershed. We started investing heavily in the Esperanza back in 1999, mass leveling the entire property and installing permanent drip infrastructure. We began to grow a lot of our lettuces with drip irrigation. We followed up with irrigation mobile lab participation and believed this was a good direction to take our farming. At the time, runoff reduction was just an added benefit, not a goal. We were concentrated simply on becoming more efficient. This was all done before the ag waiver. Decisions were made, money was invested, and in the current context, progress was made. It's this work, not added reporting requirements, that improves water quality and reduces runoff. With the implementation of the ag waiver, Quail Creek became a major focus of the effort to improve water quality, but the parameters had changed. New considerations like specific conductance, TDS levels, turbidity, nitrate and phosphate levels, organophosphate and pyrethroid levels all became increasingly important. With this increase in focus and complexity came a need to have a better snapshot of what was going on at the ranch level. For us, the saving grace was on-site confidential sampling. It allowed us to focus our efforts without much fear on the results being used against us. I promise you, everyone learns less about what's happening on the ranch if the fear of public disclosure prevents the on-site sampling in the first place. With this information, we can prioritize and go tackle the challenge of water quality. Our first sampling yielded a mixed bag of results. But the smart sampling test did reaffirm our direction with our fertility program, one which has reduced our nitrogen inputs by 38%. We also decided 2009 would be our first year of production without the use of diazinon and lorazepam, two chemicals of concern to your board. We've continued this year, evaluating as we go, and the impression we're getting is that it's possible. We're awaiting a second round of smart sampling results to get another look at the situation, to draw some conclusions, and continue to prioritize, to learn, and come up with new strategies to promote water quality. I'd like to stress to you, every ranch and every operation is different. What works for me may not work for my neighbor, but farmers share with their neighbors because we trust each other. So while I can see my solution may not work for my neighbor because his ranch is twice the size of mine, I can still share my successes with him, and that's where true progress will be made. Everyone has to do their homework, come up with their own solutions. But with smart sampling, I'm certain we can create and verify progress in this arena. Thank you for your time.
Hello again. I'm going to speak now about some water quality considerations dealing with management practices. There's a long history on the Central Coast of successful voluntary conservation and best management practices by growers, both independently and with assistance from experienced programs and partners. Perhaps due to these programs, along with grower initiative, 80% of farms either don't have surface runoff in the absence of major storms, or they've successfully dealt with their runoff using existing BMPs. So the focus of this presentation is a little bit narrow in the sense that I won't be talking about those successes. There are a lot of other folks who are much better qualified to talk about that. For example, all of these programs. The Central Coast Vineyard team has a program, several programs for grape growers dealing with sustainability. There's a similar program for citrus growers, the Positive Point System. The California Association of Nursery Growers, if you contact them, can talk about runoff management by nursery growers. The Ag Water Quality Alliance partners of the Monterey Bay area, including ALBA, CAF, NRCS, and RCDs, have done a lot of work with growers on management practices. There's the UC Cooperative Extension Management Practice Fact Sheets, and then UC and CSU researchers who I think are involved in some really exciting projects to develop management practices for what are proving to be the toughest discharge issues. So, and I just try to put enough information up here about each one that a Google search would allow anyone to find more information about any of these programs. So keeping in mind that that's the big picture, where there are a lot of success stories, I'm going to focus on the reasons for continued impairment and those farms for which the existing suite of management practices may or may not be the solution for the continuing discharge issues. In the ag waiver, there's several tools dealing with management practices. This is the ag waiver that we have presently. There's the 15-hour farm water quality planning short course, which covers many management practices and water quality topics. There's the farm water quality plan, which is 48 pages. It includes local and regional water quality information, site assessment, and practice planning. And then there's the BMP checklist, and it's kind of hard to see down there in the green field, but there's 41 management practices on that checklist. Interestingly, a grower can, in full sincerity, check off 100% of the practices on that checklist and still be a source of surface water quality impairment. Why is that? This is one example. Pesticide management question P1 asks, is an IPM, integrated pest management program, established? IPM does not preclude the use of materials which are toxic to aquatic organisms. So the implementation of IPM in and of itself will not prevent the off-site movement of materials which cause aquatic toxicity. So it's a great step forward for a grower to be able to check off that question. It's not necessarily an indicator of whether or not that farm has discharge that can contribute to aquatic toxicity. So what we have is a large collection of management and conservation practices, a long history of successful voluntary implementation, and a thorough framework for water quality management planning. What we may not have is ready-for-action tools to address the reasons why impairment continues in some farm discharges today. In some cases, again, these discharges are continuing even though BMPs have been implemented. And in many cases, when you really get down to it and analyze the reason for the discharge or the impairment, it doesn't point to the current BMP toolbox as the solution for that problem. So in a nutshell, what I'm saying is in the short term, there are some limits to the ag industry's technical capacity to meaningfully improve water quality in those agricultural discharges which currently cause surface water quality impairments. Just to put a fine point on some of this, I'm talking only about surface water here. Groundwater is a big issue, but these comments only address surface water, and some will and some won't hold true for groundwater discharges. I'm also talking only about those agricultural discharges which currently cause impairments. So again, we're not talking about all the success stories. Also talking about meaningful improvements in the short term. So can the nitrate level go down, but can the nitrate level go down to a degree that is meaningful in light of the numeric standards that we're trying to meet here? And short term versus long term, how quickly can this be accomplished? So what is the reason for these limits to technical capacity? I'm going to raise these points as questions rather than statements of fact, and hope that others will pick up with this discussion after today. One question we need to ask is, do BMPs really address the major transport mechanisms for constituents of concern in the discharges that contribute most to exceedances at CMP sites? We also need to ask, are water quality outcomes and BMP effectiveness the same thing? Are there language barriers that we have when we're communicating BMP relevance for water quality? Finally, we need to look at issues of scale. Is management practice effectiveness calibrated for the level of pollution that needs to be mitigated? So looking a little bit more closely at these, there are many BMPs that are designed to deal with diffuse sheet flows of water, with stormwater runoff, and with spray drift. And if these are the primary ways that ag discharges are impacting water bodies, then those BMPs could be expected to be effective at improving the water quality. Nitrate concentrations at most of our CMP sites are as high, if not higher, during the dry season than they are during storm events. So stormwater is important, but during most of our CMP events, it's really not a transport mechanism for pollutants into these water bodies. I try to get out of my office as much as possible, and I can honestly say that during the dry season, I have never seen a sheet flow contributing to a cooperative monitoring site. I've seen plenty of discharges contributing, but I've never seen the diffuse sheet flow that many of these BMPs are designed to address. So I'm not sure if the list of BMPs would be as long if we confined it to those practices that were effective for the transport mechanisms causing most of the impairment that we see today. So that's what I wanted to say about the first issue. About the second issue with language, this is one example. When we talk about irrigation management practices, are water quality outcomes and BMP effectiveness the same thing? So are irrigation management practices for water conservation and crop production, which are the purposes for which most of these practices were developed, are those going to result in discharge reduction? And that's an important question to ask. Another question is whether or not there's a disconnect between water quality outcomes and the way we report BMP effectiveness. This is a very texty slide. I'll just read through it quickly. These are quotes from a report on management practice effectiveness of a whole suite of BMPs from the next region south of us, from Ventura County. So one quote is, this BMP was not widely tested in this study, but results from this test combined with available data provided by other studies certainly suggest that this BMP has great potential for improving water quality and agricultural runoff. As with the water filter strips, the analytical results do not conclusively provide evidence of improved water quality below the grass filter strips. And despite the lack of supportive data produced by this project, enough evidence has been provided through other studies to suggest that a grass filter strip have the potential to be successfully implemented in agricultural settings to improve water quality. Now, I don't think that these statements are representative of every effectiveness study, and to be fair, the report that I pulled them from was fairly well balanced overall, but I think that these statements are symptomatic of an issue that we have in looking at best management practice effectiveness for water quality improvement. The last item, issues of scale and calibration. I just want to remind everyone about enzyme kinetics, which most of us probably haven't thought about since high school or college. But a lot of BMPs are based on either vegetation or microbial processes. And both of those, you know, plant uptake and also microbial processes are governed by enzymes. And enzymes have a certain capacity. An enzyme can work faster and faster with increasing levels of nitrate, for example, to a point, and then at some point it's saturated and it can't work any faster. And when you keep in mind that the level of contamination that we're seeing is orders of magnitude, in some cases, higher than the natural background, we really have to ask ourselves, are the enzymes that are doing the work of these vegetative and microbial BMPs, are they equipped to deal, again, with the scale of impairment that we're seeing? Also, just kind of some language issues, nitrates that are high in the sense of drinking water and aquatic life are actually low nitrate levels when you're looking at crop needs. And then, so are BMPs, you know, where along that scale of high to low are the BMPs calibrated to work for? And when you say it's, you know, it's for a high nitrate level to one person, does a grower hear high and think low? It's a language issue. Another language issue is when we talk about waters that are highly toxic, or we talk about lots of pesticides in the water. For some pesticides, it takes less than 0.00004 ounces of active ingredient in an average tailwater event to create a level of concern in a downstream water body. And that's not data from anyone's specific farm. It's a calculation that anyone can do. So highly toxic and lots of pesticides versus less than 0.00004 ounces of active ingredient. Did the manufacturer even consider the implications of that when they developed the product? So those are some issues to keep in mind. I wanted to go into one case study dealing with nitrogen. There are other issues to consider: pesticides, sediment, runoff volume, I'll go into a little more detail on nitrogen. As I mentioned, a lot of our monitoring sites show exceedances of nitrate 12 months a year, or close to 12 months a year. And you can see that the nitrate levels are just as high, if not higher, during the dry season as they are during the winter months. And in a typical year, only one or two of these 12 monitoring events is ever influenced by storm flows. So again, in certain months, stormwater can be a major transport mechanism, but in most of the CMP exceedances, stormwater is not the cause. So how did the nitrates get in the runoff in the first place? Well, we've got some sort of background or natural nitrate level, and you know, there's debate as to is it 0.5 milligrams per liter, 1 milligram per liter. I think there's usually consensus that it's less than 2 milligrams per liter. Point is, it's very low. Nitrates from groundwater contamination of an irrigation source can result in runoff nitrate concentrations of 0 to greater than 30 parts per million as nitrate. So on top of that natural background, before the water even goes on the field, some growers are starting with over 30 parts per million in their irrigation source. Then some nitrate can get picked up from the field surface as the water travels across. Usually that's less than 5 parts per million. And I'll share some excerpts from a conversation I had with Dr. Tim Hartz about why that is. But typically nitrate's picked up from the field regardless of the fertilizer practices. It's not usually going to add more than about 5 parts per million to that tailwater. If you add fertilizer directly to the irrigation water, obviously that's going to result in a high concentration in the runoff, but that kind of irrigation typically doesn't make its way off the farm on the surface. So the big arrow here is really going into is really coming from the groundwater. And, you know, how big a deal is that? Well, this is data from 152 high-production ag wells in the Salinas Valley. And what this shows is that 37% of these production wells have nitrate concentrations greater than 10 parts per million, and 13% of them have concentrations greater than 30%. So a lot of these production wells are starting with high nitrate concentrations before the grower does anything to the water. So obviously this speaks to the importance of addressing groundwater nitrates. That's a very important but separate discussion. But when you look at the ability of a grower to control the nitrates in their well water, it gets very complicated pretty quickly. And so the top figure here shows the wells, production wells going into different levels of the Salinas Valley aquifer. And you can see that there's several clay layers in there that those wells punch through. The lower figure shows where the water's coming from. And the figures line up fairly well spatially. So you can see that any well that goes down through one or two clay layers is receiving water not from directly above it, or at least not only from directly above it, but also from further up the valley. So please don't hear me saying that no one's responsible or that we can't fix the problem. The point is that if you're the grower tasked with fixing this problem, the nitrates in your well are not necessarily under your immediate control. Okay, so I'm going to skip over a little bit more information and leave this with the good news that most farms don't have tailwater. Of the farms that do have tailwater, some have low volumes and lower moderate nitrate concentrations, but there's existing BMPs that can help in those cases. The technical challenges are that as currently implemented, the existing menu of BMPs doesn't provide many effective options for improving nitrate concentrations in highly impaired discharges. And though it won't reduce nitrate concentrations in discharge-dominated streams, major reductions in nitrate loading are achievable with tailwater reduction or elimination. And we have to think about how we're going to choose to define that as we go forward. Are static to elevated nitrate concentrations in reduced flow volumes, is that worsening water quality, or is that an indicator of success because the discharges have been reduced?
Good afternoon. My name is Tim Hartz. I'm an agronomist with the University of California, Davis. I've worked with the vegetable and strawberry industries in the Central Coast for some period of years now. I've been asked today to come and provide some technical information to you regarding the issues of pollution defined either as concentration of nitrate or as load. I don't appear as an advocate for any position here. I'm strictly here to provide some background technical information. As Sarah ended her talk, she alluded to this issue of, is success in reducing farm-based pollution achieved by solely by looking at the concentration of nitrate in the water that exists on the surface, or are we more interested in the overall loading, the total amount of nitrogen escaping farms impacting surface waters? This is important because at least in my reading of the draft proposal, most of the focus is on concentration. And it's entirely possible that we could get some period of years down the road without seeing major changes in concentration and totally miss substantial improvements in on-farm management of nitrogen. Because, as Sarah alluded to, if we can control the volumes moving, we can indeed control the loading that's happening in the environment. There are some practical limitations that growers have in terms of controlling the concentration of nitrogen that ends up in surface waters. The primary one is this issue of the nitrate that is now in many of the well waters that people are using for irrigation. And there is, at this point in time, no practical on-farm mechanism by which growers could remove that nitrate before a surface flowing water source would take that off farm. My colleague Michael Kahn, who you'll hear from a little bit later, farm advisor here in the Salinas Valley for the UC, has done a number of different individual farm trials, commercial scale trials, looking at various practices to modify the loss of pollutants, nitrate as well as others. In the course of that, we've gotten a pretty good flavor for the nitrate dynamics in runoff. This is a little bit of that data. These are five individual fields. They range from wells that were very low in nitrate to wells that were substantially above the legal standard for drinking water. If you look at the blue bars, which are the concentrations of nitrate in the runoff as it exited the field, what you'll find is two things. You have, in all cases, a slightly higher concentration of nitrate than was the original well water, but that difference is typically somewhere between 3 and 5 parts per million, meaning that for those discharges that exceed the 10 part per million standard, the overwhelming majority of that is coming from the water itself. Second issue to bring up in that regard is that there have been a lot of people talking about conservation practices to remove pollutants from discharge of irrigated fields, things like vegetated ditches, filter strips, etc. These may have very good effectiveness for certain pollutants, as in sediment, perhaps sediment-attached pesticides, but for nitrate, they really have very limited effectiveness. To give you an idea, this is, again, data from Michael, a couple different years' worth of trials where for both microbial food safety and pesticide nutrient pollution issues, evaluations in the field scale were done looking at whether or not vegetating ditches made a difference in reducing pollutant loads. With regard to nitrate, the answer is basically not. There's not sufficient residence time for the volume of flow to have any substantive effect of removing nitrate in that flow. More data to support that particular contention. There have been probably 5 or 6 years' worth of reasonably concentrated efforts in the wintertime looking at runoff flows from storm events and seeing which types of vegetative practices, cover crops or furrow bottom, low-mass cover crops, other kinds of vegetative approaches to reduce pollutant loads from winter runoff, we find again with the context of nitrate that whether it's bare, whether it's vegetated, no consistent effect of removing nitrates in that system. The other issue that we really need to address is it practical to not discharge nutrients in the course of farming in those areas where you have surface water affected by leached water going through a fertilized root zone? These would be obviously where you have tile drains coming back to surface water or where you have some degree of lateral flow affecting water in creeks. There are some, again, practical limitations on agriculture that will make control of nitrate losses and especially the concentration-based control down to 10 part per million very difficult or impossible to reach. We take a cropping example, using lettuce as the biggest crop for the coast. If you just do the pure stoichiometry, a high-yield lettuce crop will contain about 120 pounds of nitrogen in its biomass per acre at harvest. It will have transpired about 8 inches of water during the course of a normal summer season in Mid-Valley. If you just do the math, accepting that the most of the nitrogen that is pulled up in the crop is taken in that transpirational stream, most of the nitrate exists in soils in nitrate, or most of the nitrogen is taken up in nitrate form. What it turns out to be is the average concentration of nitrate that has to be in that transpired water is something in excess of 50 parts per million nitrate in. That is the agronomic reality. The other issue regarding surface waters that we heard briefly discussed this morning is this issue of salinity control and the discharge of salts. Well, obviously, nitrate is a salt. But the crops that are grown on the coast here have the unfortunate characteristic of being very salt sensitive. This data comes from a 2-year intensive study conducted just a few years ago looking at the effects of salinity on the yield of lettuce. What you see is once the water salinity exceeds about 1 decisiemen per meter, or roughly 700 parts per million, lettuce is negatively impacted. This is also true of strawberry, and in fact, strawberry is a little more sensitive even than lettuce. So as soil salinity increases beyond that threshold, you progressively lose yield potential. To give you a standard of comparison, those growers now using the CSIP Castroville recycled water are receiving water on farm typically between 1.2 and 1.5 decisiemen concentration, so already beyond the theoretical threshold for lettuce yield loss. In Santa Maria area, typical well water concentrations for salts somewhere between 1 and up to 2 decisiemens. So again, by definition, they are already in the zone of yield loss potential. And some degree of movement of salts out of those root zones are absolutely mandatory to allow maximum production to continue. So I would just summarize by saying there are ways that growers can reduce the total loading of the environment with nitrogen of ag origin, better use of irrigation, or better control of irrigation, fertilizer management, reduced usage of fertilizers. But if the standard of success is going to be solely based on a concentration standard, we have the likelihood of missing important improvements that ag may make unless we look at the issue holistically and consider load as well as concentration. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and board members. My name is Dirk Giannini. I'm a fourth-generation farmer in the Salinas Valley. Our family-owned and operated company farms a variety of row crops that vary from head lettuce, romaine lettuce, broccoli, to spinach, carrots, and spring mix. All of these crops require different amounts and methods of irrigation and fertilizer. I'd like to share with some of the practices we have used on our ranches to prevent our ag inputs from entering downstream waterways. We continue to adapt and refine these and work with the UC Cooperative Extension and others to consider new ideas. You might be surprised to know that it is a challenge to find management practices that can, one, reduce nitrates in surface water down to below drinking water standards, two, assure us that no nutrients or ag chemicals are still in our tailwater, three, and is to eliminate tailwater from crops that must be sprinkle irrigated. But we want to find those practices, so we keep looking. Our ultimate goal is to make sure our tailwater is clean before it leaves our ranches. That is a tall order when we are pumping water from aquifers that are already high in nitrates and trying to make that water drinkable before it leaves the ranch. The area east of Salinas, where we farm, is steeply sloped with soils of decomposed granite and sandy loam. Here we have tried and continue to work with various practices such as vegetative ditches, the use of PAM in sprinkler irrigation, the application of LandGuard, and the use of drip irrigation. The vegetative ditch sections were planted back in 2004 and 2006 with the support of the Resource Conservation District and Community Alliance of Family Farmers. Their purpose is to prevent sediment in the irrigation water from leaving the ranch. This means we're also preventing anything contained in that sediment from leaving. We sloped back the ditches and planted 100-foot sections all over the ranch. The grasses have done a good job of holding sediment on the ranches. But with the onset of food safety concerns, we are reluctant to expand this practice further. However, we still maintain the 6 grass plots that we originally established and continue to look for other ways to reach our water quality goal. For example, we have had very positive results with a sediment-holding polymer known as PAM. We have worked with the UC Cooperative Extension performing multiple trials that have shown us that PAM can drop sediment immediately in the field so it never ends up in the ditch. Consequently, it also drops anything else attached to the sediment. UC Extension has documented the effectiveness of this product. On ranches where we farm crops that require sprinkler irrigation with highly erodible soils, the use of PAM would be an excellent farm practice. A third management practice we have tried is called LandGuard. This is an enzyme that breaks down pesticides in tailwater. This practice has significantly reduced exceedances and would clean our tailwater before it leaves the ranch. The problem is that this practice has not been readily accepted by the Regional Water Board staff. In our watershed working groups, I have heard success stories about this product from neighbors and have witnessed it myself in the sampling program that is part of our education and outreach. Since there is not buy-in from the regional board, regardless of its effectiveness, we will have to set this practice aside and not pursue further implementation at this time. Finally, our company has used drip irrigation and fertigation since 1991 on a number of crops, although sprinkler is still needed in the first few growing weeks to ensure crop germination. Our challenge now is to shrink the period of time that we use sprinklers on the crops and also to see if we can use drip on more crops. We have seen water usage drop on some locations as much as 30%. We have also been able to spoon feed fertilizer directly to the root zone where the plant has the best access to it. Because of these practices, our fertilizer usage has dropped considerably. Leaf wetness means less mildew and the use of less fungicides. We continue to invest in drip tape application. It is very expensive to install, maintain, and store, and it does not solve all water quality problems. In closing, we will continue to put our energy into these efforts and hope that scientists will continue their research in developing new management practices. 3 things are clear to me, and I hope I've made them clear to you. 1, no single practice will work on every ranch the same way. 2, no single practice will solve every water quality problem. And 3, a full range of proven effective management practices that will assure me I can achieve all water quality objectives that meet regulatory standards is not readily available today. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chairman, board members. Greetings again from the hinterlands of Carpinteria. I spoke earlier, and my name is Rick Shade, and I would like to just add a few more comments to my comments of earlier. I am a fifth-generation California farmer, sixth, depending on how you break things down. But I want to go over a couple other things. I manage properties both organically and conventionally. There were some comments made this morning about the differences between conventional and organic, but I think it's important to note that nitrate nitrogen is nitrate nitrogen, whether it comes from organic source or from a fertilizer bag. That's a distinction that is lost on some folks, and I think it needs to be brought up. But some of the other practices we've done on our farms in Carpinteria, and it's important to also note that we have no tailwater. Not only do we not have tailwater leaving the ranch, we don't have tailwater, period, through the use of drip irrigation and microsprinklers. And that includes we're farming on some slopes that would probably sometimes take our guys' rock climbing gear to harvest the trees safely. But on all our wells and all our municipal water sources, we have backflow devices. Every single one. We use green waste mulch from the county for mulching bare land where we can't get a cover crop to establish. We have stopped all use in over the last 8 or 10 years of long-term soil-active residual herbicides, pre-emergent herbicides. We use no more of that. So there are a number of things that we have already done, and I would like to once again advocate for some of the ideas of looking at separate areas and separate crops under different microscopes. Thank you.
Hello, board. I'm Jeff Rosendale. I'm a nursery grower in Watsonville, California, locally. The ranch I want to talk to you about, I've been growing on for 20 years, and I've been a grower in this county for 30 years. Basically, I wanted to express to you the BMP practice that we use, that many nurseries use, outdoor container grower nurseries use, and we do our own monitoring, and we're involved with Preservation, Inc. in smart monitoring. Recently, and some results I'd just like to share with you quickly here. Our well water we tested when we first started growing at the nursery in 1988, and the nitrate concentration in the well is low at 1.7 parts per million. And we tested with Preservation, Inc. in June, and the concentration of nitrates 1.8 parts per million, so basically the same. As far as the leachate that comes out of our containers in outdoor field nursery production, I want to emphasize that we and most nurseries use slow-release fertilizers, 8 to 9 month slow-release fertilizers. So the word slow there is important to acknowledge. And here's some quick results that I would like to share with you, and we will keep monitoring as part of our own BMP process. But in September, actually October of 2003, we sampled our leachate and coming out of our container, and the soil conditions are starting to cool in the fall, and they were 9 parts per million of nitrate nitrogen, which we consider low and very manageable. We did the same sampling this summer after a warm period, not like the weather now, but a warm period a couple of weeks ago. And the results were higher at 12.7 parts per million nitrate in the leachate from the containers. But we have implemented a 300-foot vegetative filter. It's been since the farm plan was implemented in 2004, and so it has 6 years of growth and a lot of microbial activity. And so at the end of that vegetative ditch, the nitrate levels were 7.4. parts per million nitrate, a 40% reduction. So I would, again, like to emphasize our use of BMP practice of slow-release fertilizers with low releases, slow releases, and uses of vegetative and organic methods of biological interaction with the nutrients, and, again, a great reduction in any kind of tailwater. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to working with the waiver in the future. Thank you.
You guys have about 3 minutes left, just to let you know.
I'm timing it, and we have seven. I timed it before.
Yeah, he shortchanges at the start. So
okay.
Should have had about 5 minutes.
Okay, go. All right, go.
My name's Aaron Dillon. I'm a fourth-generation nurseryman here in California. We have a new location here in Watsonville. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what Jeff said because we adopted a lot of similar practices, use of slow-release fertilizers. We've used drip irrigation since the 70s. The big thing that's different for us, we're a citrus nursery. We're facing the arrival of a new pest called the Asian citrus psyllid. It's going to require us to begin producing our stock under insect-proof screen conditions. We're also going to be required by USDA and CDFA to apply certain chemicals to those products before we can ship. We intend to develop systems to capture the runoff off of these greenhouses so that we can reuse that water. But the point I really want to make is that we're facing some significant financial requirements to continue to do operation. And so to continue to provide these additional steps to capture water is going to take some time for us to just generate the necessary capital to put those systems in place. So we certainly acknowledge what the board is trying to do, but would just hope that we can develop a timeline that's going to make it feasible for us to implement those things and remain a viable business. Thank you.
How much time?
We have 4 minutes.
No. That
okay. That solve the problem
question,
in 4 minutes.
Question's not for you, Ms. Fisher. How when you say you just need time, I mean...
Well, we just purchased a new nursery, right? So we're in the process of developing the screen production facilities. Right now, it's only money out. It's going to take me a year before I can start even generating a crop and beginning to make some income.
Right.
We're committed to being sustainable producers. We're involved in the process of creating a sustainable standard for production agriculture. Yeah. So we want to do these things, but... It's got to be done in a feasible manner. I want to last point. We're working with PG&E right now. They have made it clear that they want to be energy efficient. So they've provided us with funding to go ahead and make investments in energy efficient tools and mechanisms. If there's ways to get grant funding, whether it's through USDA, maybe through Farm Bill, anything like that to help offset some of the costs for us will allow us to do it much faster.
Is the 5-year
5 years is going to be cutting it for us. I mean, and this is, we're in a unique situation. I think the other point that I hope came out with Jeff is that nurseries definitely have, different production practices and sort of different criteria with how we operate. So, I acknowledge that the board is looking, staff's looking at maybe creating a separate standard or a different standard, and I think that's appropriate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also submitted a 2-minute timesheet, if I could go into that, but thank you, Chairman Young, board members, staff. My name is Eric Jertberg. I'm the third generation in a family of California strawberry growers. I'm here on behalf of more than just my family. In fact, the 23,000 acres of strawberries within District 3 support tens of thousands of employees and their families. As a farmer who grows and harvests berries throughout the year, I'd like to give my perspective on a couple areas I'm concerned about in the draft waiver and its economic impact to our ranches and our ability to continue farming in the Central Coast. Do I have that time to go ahead and do that, sir?
Yeah, you have time because I think that there's more time. Yeah. So let's add 7 minutes right now. Okay. 7 minutes from this point. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairman Young. The first concern I'd like to discuss is the need to move salts through the root zone using irrigation water. Drip irrigation systems are highly efficient in reducing the amount of water used to produce a crop. All strawberry production fields use drip irrigation systems. These systems virtually eliminate tailwater discharges, but also lead to the concentration of salts in the root zone. Strawberries are a highly salt-sensitive crop. Salts reaching toxic EC levels must be leached from the root zone in order to produce a crop. Strawberry growers use irrigation water to flush salts from the root zone during both the plant establishment period and during the season when salts naturally accumulate due to evaporation and transpiration. Strawberries cannot be produced in the Central Coast unless growers are allowed to use irrigation water to leach salts from the root zone. This leads me to my second concern. As a third-generation farmer, I have watched as our practices have evolved and our effectiveness at utilizing our limited tools has improved. Our ability to deliver fertilizer directly to the root zone through drip irrigation has significantly improved how much of the fertilizer is used by the plant. However, this current staff proposal would require growers to manage their fertilizer application such that 90% or more of the nitrogen would be utilized by the crop or retained in the root zone. Currently, there are no production practices in the world for growing strawberries in the soil that can come close to achieving this goal. For several years, I was in charge of the largest organic strawberry ranch in the nation. Under the proposed regulations, organic growers would face an even greater challenge than the conventional farmers. And I want to say that in earnest. Due to the crude nature of the materials allowed in organic farming, a lot of those farming practices require additional leaching of those salts in order to maintain a sufficient crop. However, with that said, the only way to meet the staff recommendations regarding salt leaching would be to stop all strawberry production in the Central Coast. That cannot be the direction that the board wants to go. That's not the direction that I want to go, and that cannot be the direction the tens of thousands of people and families depending on our industry want us to go. The strawberry growers here are committed to the development and implementation of best management practices that will continue to preserve the water quality where we live, work, and grow. To achieve that goal, the board should remember that environmental progress must be integrated with the economic viability of the growers they are working with. Without achievable goals and a reasonable plan for implementing them, the ag waiver will drive strawberry growers out of business. And as a third-generation farmer, with hopes of seeing my sons becoming a fourth generation growing in this valley, I urge you to consider the recommendations being offered by the agriculture group. Thanks.
Chairman Young, fellow board members, I got to say, after hearing everybody's generational failure, I'm a seventh generation Californian. And one of the reasons I'm here is I'm hoping my kids who are going to represent the eighth generation will be able to continue on farming. So I had to get that in for those guys who were before me. With that, the agricultural community thanks you for the opportunity to address the board today at your workshop. As you are well aware, and in hearing from our speakers today, water quality issues associated with agricultural surface water along the Central Coast are extremely complex. The agricultural community remains committed to the goal of improving the quality of water discharged from its fields over time. As you've heard today, there are many farmers throughout the region already engaged in a voluntary form of smart sampling. In an effort to increase the efficacy of both fertilizers and insecticides being applied to their crops, farmers continue to work cooperatively with manufacturers of both fertilizers and pesticides to incorporate their uses. The latest technologies allow farmers to target specific pests using softer, more environmentally compatible materials. Agriculture as a collective group looks forward to sharing a multitude of information, technical issues, and presentations in the future. We are asking for an additional opportunities and meetings which we can discuss our issues, results, and solutions in greater depth with both staff and board members. Currently, we are working with Howard Cole from your staff to initiate the first meeting with your staff as directed by Chairman Young at the May 12th workshop. We think it would also be advantageous to schedule a short workshop with your board at your December meeting, allowing the ag community to discuss our smart sampling program in greater depth while reviewing the revised MRP by staff that should be available at that time. We'd also want the board to fully understand the diversity of agricultural operations found throughout Region 3, and the challenges of communicating with such a vast farming community is extremely important that all farmers throughout the region are given an opportunity to express their ideas and solutions related to agricultural water quality. We are hopeful by December that those opportunities will be realized. The agricultural community appreciates the opportunity to participate in today's workshop, and we look forward to a continued meaningful dialogue as we work together on the focused goal of improving water quality over time here in Region 3. Thank you very much. That concludes the ag presentation.
You have a minute and 35 seconds to go. Ms. Fisher, do you want to?
Don't worry.
You're going to speak later?
Okay.
I thought you were part of this presentation.
No, actually, I was going to speak on something else, but I can do it now.
Okay.
Okay, Carrie Fisher with the California Farm Bureau Federation.
We, the ag community, as well as California Farm Bureau, have a lot of concerns with what happened at the conclusion of the May 12th workshop and what has happened to date. Specifically, our concerns relate to the directives that you, Chairman Young, and fellow board members gave specifically to your staff that we have yet to see any indication of those happening, if at all. Specifically, staff were directed to prepare a memo outlining all types of trade secrets, proprietary information, and confidential business records, as well as the provisions of the Water Code, which allow for privacy of such proprietary information. Prepare a legal memorandum by board counsel responding to all of the legal issues raised by agriculture in written comments presented orally at the workshop, and evaluate the information and the amount of information needed by the board that they need to request from growers, with the expectation that most of the records should be kept on farm, and also consider staff's capacity to manage this requested data. So far, none of the directives that you gave to your staff have been met, except for Howard Kolb and Lisa McCann contacting agriculture to set up a meeting after we initiated it in a separate request. So we'd really like some direction on when those things will happen, if ever.
Okay. Well, sure.
Question.
Mr. Shallcross.
I have a question for you. Were those the specific words that were used to give those directions?
Written down as verbatim as we could.
Okay. And can you provide us with where that was in the record?
It's in the last...
Because so I remember
around
some of those...
7:25 p.m.
Could you provide us specifically where it is in the record so that we can review it? I don't specifically remembering the wording as you just said.
We also sent a letter, so it's in your board packet, outlining all the directives that
in,
you were given.
Okay.
I just want to make a comment about that. You made the request to have responses to those questions, some of which are legal questions. And as the lawyer for the board, I will be advising the board and helping to respond to all the comments.
I didn't make the request. Chairman Young and other members of your
board
made the request.
I know, and the request was to provide a response, not provide a response by today. The response to the comments, including legal responses, will be prepared in the future as we get closer to adoption of a proposal, and you will be provided that. And it wasn't intended to be provided by today. I'm not going to provide a response till I get all the comments and all the questions answered. So in terms of legal responses, they'll be forthcoming, but certainly I had no intention, and I don't think anybody on the board expected those to be done today. But you will be receiving, there will be written responses to all the comments, including the legal comments, prior to the board's adoption of any changes to the waiver or any other method they use to adopt.
Okay.
Waiver.
Yeah, if my comments misled you, you know, I apologize for that, you know, to the audience, but I just wanted to make sure that staff covered these things before we see staff's final report. I'm expecting it to be within in the report.
Okay.
Was not expecting anything to be presented today, certainly not specific comments on specific letters and items like that. This is the continuation of the workshop. So we're still gathering information.
Right. Just a lot of those questions that were raised will lead your staff in one direction or another, and they can't make a draft report or a final report until they already answer the other questions out there.
Well, they're going to answer them as they normally do at the end of the public comment period on this, as they're putting together, you know, their report. So I'm not expecting them to shift gears right now and to start providing answers to specific issues that have been raised.
Do we have a loose deadline of maybe when such a report
will come
up?
It's going to be as part of their staff report, I'm sure.
Okay.
Now, there may be some specific legal issues that we've asked our attorney to help us with and consider. Those may or may not be disclosed to the public. We have an attorney to advise us on things. If anything's supposed to be disclosed, it would be disclosed according to the law. If we're allowed to keep certain things confidential, we will do that.
Oh, I know. I'm just repeating back to you what was said in public for public
and
response.
And I want to clarify at least what I said so everyone is very clear about that. So there may not be a legal memo that gets disclosed, but all of the issues regarding, you know, trade secrets and confidentiality,
mm-hmm.
I want to make sure staff thoroughly addresses that when they bring this back to us in their staff report.
Okay. So, thank you.
Okay. All right. Schmidt, you're leaning forward.
I was just going to clean off the podium.
Okay. I try to anticipate everything, even when Mr. Jeffries starts to lean forward.
Well,
but I did want to ask Mr. Hartz, is that his name? Tim Hartz, if he could come back up here, because you had some interesting slides. And can we put that one back up? It was a bar graph with about six groups of data.
Thank you, Chris.
And Mr. Hartz, it's Hartz, right?
Yes.
H-A-R-Z. If, okay. Sarah Green had told us that everyone probably agrees that less than two parts per million would be kind of natural background levels of nitrogen.
Well, I think what Sarah said is no more than that would likely be natural.
Okay.
But some natural waters would be lower than two.
Okay. So how are we getting, I mean, the kind of, it seemed like spin on this data that ag is not responsible for the nitrate in water that's coming up in their well water.
No, the point is that in the achievement of a 10 part per million standard, concentration standard, in a creek affected by runoff from irrigated ag, if the well as it exists today has, for example, 10 parts per million, or 9, say, that there will be, in general, some small contribution, a few parts per million, off the field surface that is typical of what we see, but in the water that ends up in the creek from that field, where there are elevated nitrates that exceed the 10 part per million standard, most of that is originating with the water drawn up from the well.
Right.
It's not originating from an ag practice applied by the grower in that field.
Well, where is it coming from in the well water?
Well, now, not being a hydrologist, I'm not quite prepared to answer that in detail. The question, of course, is can you make a statement that the water existing today under a piece of land is only influenced by the current owner and his practices? I mean, that's the import of your question.
Well, it's not to pinpoint an individual property owner, but I think an industry-wide practice. I mean, if we're talking about ag, I'm thinking about how did we get, look at field number 3.
Mm-hmm.
There's almost 40 parts per million.
Exceedingly elevated, that's correct.
Yeah, and that groundwater. Certainly it's not one property owner having caused that, but probably an area.
Probably an area over an extended period of time, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, as Mr. Chairman, I was struck by the same thing. It seems that the argument is, well, we have groundwater degradation, and we've cited reports that show in irrigated ag areas up to, I don't know, 83% or something is from the genesis is from farming operations. So what you're saying is the farmers have contaminated the groundwater. And so now the groundwater that they're using is contaminated, and so they can't have water running off their field that meets any standards.
Well, what I am saying, again, in a technical context, not specifically leading you to a regulatory outcome, that there is today, as the world exists, a limitation that a grower who has elevated nitrates in irrigation water effectively must impound that water, or it's going to carry the current load of nitrates into surface water. That's the reality of it, and there is not a practice or set of practices that they can employ short of impoundment that's substantively going to remove that nitrate. That's the technical information I'm trying to display. I'm not saying who is responsible for the nitrate, what is should be the legal status of the discharge. I'm just saying that is the technical condition that we that exists today.
And I think that I understand. But the other side of this is there's a water quality receiving standard for nitrogen. And if we've got a surface water body that's already elevated, maybe it's a 303 delisted body for nutrients, we're not going to look at where they're getting the water from. If they're choosing to use well water that's naturally elevated, that's a choice they're making.
That becomes a regulatory issue that you folks will decide. All I'm trying is to put out the information that would hopefully guide you to understand the ramifications of any rule that you come up with.
Yeah, I understand.
And that is clearly leading to the concept that reduction of tailwater volume is critical for improving the watershed-wide surface water concentration. But short of complete elimination, what I'm suggesting is in a monitoring program going forward where you're taking dip samples out of a creek influenced mostly by field runoff or tile drain emissions, you cannot expect large concentration drops in a short term. All you can expect is a confined volume, a reducing volume applied such that the load to the environment is also being decreased.
Okay. I mean, what about requiring filtration of that water before it leaves the property?
Filtration?
I mean, for nitrogen removal.
Okay, short of RO, there is no filtration that is an option. You can certainly say you must apply a reverse osmosis system to cleanse salts from that water. But for nitrate-specific removal, again, beyond my technical expertise here, but based on what municipalities have to do, there's not a real simple solution to removing nitrate specifically from a water.
Okay. One of the other speakers had given us some slides with vegetated buffers it was a gentleman who had some specific farm data from his farm that suggested that he was able to show improvements in certain portions of his vegetated ditches. And I'm just wondering, perhaps there is some way to do this.
A couple things I'd say about that. If you look at the totality of the field trials that have been conducted in Salinas, say, in the last 10 years, and it's probably by different people, a couple dozen of them, you'll have a handful that show some significant reduction. Out of the two dozen, the majority showing effectively no reduction in nitrate concentration. Part of it goes back to the volume flow versus the configuration and length of the vegetative strip. Where you have, for example, a nursery, the volume flows will tend to be relatively low. You may have a longer residence time going through a vegetated path, whereas on a irrigated field, the volume flow is such that you have a very short residence time going through a vegetated strip, and that's probably the difference.
Okay.
So what you're saying is if there are more vegetated strips, there's more length, there's more vegetated area for the water to flow through, it's going to be more effective in removing
nitrogen. Think you could make a statement of more effective. Whether you can make a statement of significantly effective is still a question, because the filtration is not the issue. The nitrate can only be removed by either uptake by a plant or microbial action. It's not like sediment where a vegetative strip is going to actually make it fall out of the water column.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Okay.